see where AI is going. So why can't I just walk into, I know these technologies are being developed, but I have not seen them run in real time yet. Why can't I go into a room and the computer listens and understands kind of how I interact with patients, listens to the patient and develops the document, which I then review and sign off.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is about where is AI going and what is this going to mean for healthcare? With all the advances in AI and technology, and especially in medicine, we're exploring today what will these advances mean for healthcare models. My guest today, Dr. Tim Hindmarsh, who's a board-certified physician and is currently practicing urgent care, will be here to answer these questions from the perspective of a medical doctor. Welcome, Tim. Thanks for being on the show today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Let's start by you telling me a bit about your background.
Okay, so I was born actually in Canada, educated at the University of Saskatchewan, grew up in the small city of Saskatoon. Practiced there very, very briefly. And then we were recruited into the Pacific Northwest of the United States. I was windsurfing a lot at the time, and I really wanted to live close to the Columbia Gorge. I'd lived in Whistler. I still am an avid downhill skier. So geography was a big deal to me. So we decided that the Northwest would work really well for us. So my wife is also a physician. We actually graduated medical school on a Thursday and got married that Sunday. So, and then we came down here and did a wide variety of medical practice. We were true country doctors. I delivered babies for 12 years. I worked in the ICU. I did even death investigations. We helped the local coroner out. It was a wonderful way to learn medicine. It was a very rewarding practice. And then healthcare started to become more corporatized. We kind of saw how things were happening with, you know, various government legislations like the Affordable Care Act, et cetera. And we moved over to urgent care. Primary care was just becoming very regulated, at least from our perspective. Yeah. And so I've been doing urgent care. I'm doing a little bit of primary care now. I work a couple days a week, and then we have our podcast and other things that we're interested in as we kind of transition out of medicine in the next several years.
Very interesting. So you're really the perfect person to speak to because you've seen so many different sides of delivering medicine from a doctor perspective. I've kind of explored this topic with someone in pharma. I've explored it with a healthcare AI vendor. So now we're getting down to the coalface of, you know, what's it actually mean on the ground, which is quite cool. So I think that what I'm seeing, particularly in the last 20 years, is medicine's really evolved quite a lot in terms of what people accept and don't accept. So for example, in 2000, I was working with a doctor who was delivering telemedicine, and he was actually told by the GMC, which is the General Medical Council in the UK, that he was not allowed to do it. And he was told he had to stop practicing. He was struck off basically because he did telemedicine. And in today, you know, in 2023, it's so shocking that an organization like that can be so out of touch and unpatient-centric, really. But that's only the tip of the iceberg with what's happening with technology and healthcare. Could you tell me what you see as a physician and where you've seen AI and technology used in medicine?
Well, I mean, the thing that comes to mind, and I don't know how much I've actually seen, but I know I've talked to various people. I have a friend that's done a lot of angel investing in various healthcare technologies. Is, you know, the I guess the lowest hanging fruit I see as far as AI and medicine is radiology, because it's pattern recognition over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And, the stories I've heard as far as how quickly machine learning can learn how to read x-rays and how much more accurate it is than, board certified radiologist, which is, you know, what, 14 years of training is pretty staggering. As far as its adoption, that I don't know about. I know from what I've seen, they're using a tremendous amount of AI in drug development, which makes perfect sense. As far as actual, you know, feet on the ground, seeing patients, day-to-day stuff that I see, I wouldn't, I mean, honestly, I'm ignorant enough, I probably wouldn't even recognize it if it was there.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. During COVID, the lung x-rays, there were two different systems. I think one was from the Alibaba group. I forgot the name of it. And they could do it, you know, diagnose COVID within 14 seconds or something from an x-ray. Right. It was incredible. And we've seen that with oncology as well. I remember there was one study done where five leading oncologists were pitted against the AI for predicting tumor progression from scans. And the AI was more successful than them. But I guess if you think about it, it makes sense because the AI is learning from thousands of doctors, you know, you've all the experience that's out there that's recorded. So yeah, it's very interesting. I think one of that whole prediction aspect is definitely one that I think is going to increase and increase. Certainly all sorts of aspects of prediction. I had Grail, that company that do the single blood draw and use AI to diagnose over 50 types of cancer in healthy people. And so we're seeing more and more of that predictability. Have you seen in hospitals outside of the lung kind of things, anything like that used?
Not that I really know of, but I tell you what's really changed. I mean, I still work in a small town. The town I live in is about 11,000 people. Mm-hmm. We have a fairly busy private practice. But just what's happening with urine cultures is fascinating because now, like, everything is genetic testing. Yeah. So you can test for virtually every single pathogen off of one test. I don't know, you know, if AI was used to develop that, but it really is amazing because we're finding things in patients that have, you know, recurrent urinary tract infections, which doesn't sound like a big deal until you're the person that has it and you've tried all these different antibiotics and nothing's working. And now, I mean, we're in a small rural area. We do a test, we get it back. Oh, well, here's a pathogen we never thought about. Boom, problem solved. It's really pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that whole predictability, I think, will be a part that probably the practice of medicine will move more from the AI doing the diagnostics and the physicians doing the treatment, potentially.
Yes. And, you know, I guess the concern I always have is with, you know, kind of convincing people or, you know, even convincing ourselves as far as the safety. Like, I always just kind of think of Skynet from the Terminator, you know, and it's like, are we turning over these very intimate relationships? You know, the doctor-patient relationship is a very, you know, it's a relationship 100% based on trust. You're dealing with some very routine things, but you're also dealing with life and death. You know, I think of when I had my obstetrical practice, like there's nothing more, you know, a bigger privilege than to be able to share this, you know, amazing event of having children with families. And so there's such a human part of medicine. And I think a lot of people are kind of jaded, especially after COVID. I thought that with the amount of telehealth I did during COVID, that would become the standard operating procedure in healthcare. And it didn't. It's been quite largely rejected by most of our patients. They really want to be seen in person. So from a clinical perspective, seeing patients, I can see how AI would be very helpful as a tool in the toolbox, like a digital stethoscope.
Yeah.
But we can't get in the way of that human relationship, because I think that the demand for that now, especially after we've come through the lockdowns and whatnot, is bigger.
Yeah.
Because people missed it.
Yeah.
And it still boggles my mind how in even a 10-minute encounter, how quickly you can connect with people when it's person to person. And so that would be kind of my concern.
Yeah.
I also get very concerned about technologies that get developed very quickly and we're not sure what they do. Like I think of nuclear energy. It was great. Yeah. I mean, it's, I think nuclear energy actually is something that can absolutely revolutionize if we're going to have electric cars, but we adopted it so quickly. And then we had, you know, two or three massive disasters. And now it's like, okay, well, who wants to do that anymore? Even though the technology we have now is not the technology we had 50 years ago.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, the biggest concern with a lot of AI development right now is the ethics and, you know, how it's being used. And there's so much, I guess, in Europe, at least, there's a lot of governance and regulations that have come into play around privacy of data and, you know, all that kind of area. But you're right, it's the technology itself is great, but you've got to be very careful that you're using it for the right purposes. And
I mean, a place I could see it used just in my actual clinical experience, this, and I can't speak for what it's like in the United Kingdom, but I can tell you for what it's like in the United States. The single biggest disruptor in the doctor-patient relationship in the outpatient world, you know, when you go to see your GP or you go to, you know, ER, et cetera, is the electronic medical record.
Mm.
Okay. Like if you polled virtually every physician and you said, what is the thing that's, you know, the biggest pain in your, you know, your life, it gets in the way of seeing patients, et cetera, it's the EMR. And, you know, I just, you see where AI is going. So why can't I just walk in? I know these technologies are being developed, but I have not seen them run in real time yet. Mm-hmm. Why can't I go into a room and the computer listens and understands kind of how I interact with patients, listens to the patient and develops the document, which I then review and sign off.
Yeah.
So I don't have to have a keyboard. I don't have to be clicking boxes. It listens to all it for all of these cues and it produces the note. If you want this to like blow up in a primary care setting, that would be the thing that would change the world. Because it, back to what I said before, now it's a tool that actually helps me engage more simply human to human. It's getting the electronic interface kind of out of the way and in the background. And it's doing a better job at documenting than I could ever do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's key. It's quite interesting because we, with sales reps, you know, we actually are doing those kind of things where it basically listens and writes up the sales call into the CRM and does all that kind of thing. So it's certainly possible to do that with electronic medical record. It's not that huge a step to do it because we've now got the right technology to do it. So I'm surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if someone's actually working on that right now. Wouldn't be surprised if it's Amazon.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I mean, I've said this for decades now. The changes and the revolution in healthcare is not going to come from physicians and hospitals. It's going to come from completely tangential technologies. Mm. That's usually how things happen.
Yeah.
Right? You know, digital music didn't come from musicians. It came from, you know, computer developers.
Yeah.
And I think the same kind of thing is going to happen in healthcare where for most things, you know, you're just going to speak, you're going to breathe into a device. It's going to analyze, you know, what's in your lungs, or you're going to, you know, poke your finger and drop a blood. And it's just going to do a lot of this work for us.
Yeah.
Kind of a la Star Trek. I mean, I see that's where it's going. The human interface in medicine, will it go away? I don't know. Maybe if it was really, really effective, you know, the machines we have are really effective and safer than, I guess, just like a lot of things. You know, we don't have a lot of people making wooden wheels for carts anymore.
It's interesting because I remember probably about 8 years ago, someone made the tricorder that was in Star Trek. So there was a company, I think it was Omnicom, or I can't remember who did it. And they put a $10 million prize for whoever developed the tricorder from Star Trek. And it was developed, and it only did at that time, I think, 12 or 13 conditions. But it was like, you know, beep, 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 beep over the body. And it diagnosed about 12 or 13. But they were developing it to do more. But I haven't really followed where they got to with that. But yes, I think that makes sense. And I think, like with anything with AI, at least in pharma where we work, it's all about augmenting the human process and making it easier for the human to do their job better. And so what you're saying is exactly that. You know, I think you're still going to need the doctor there, but I think having what you said just then, you know, automatically doing everything into the EMR without you having to do it, would speed up your time and allow you to have better quality time with the patient and not be so overloaded with, you know, trying to get the admin done. So I'm sure there's lots of areas like that that it could really help medical practice while augmenting what the physician does.
Yeah, I think that's the key. I mean, when you look at it from a market perspective, you know, or a patient perspective, I mean, what does the patient want? I mean, they want to be respected. They want to be treated with dignity. They want to be able to get in when they need to get in, and they want their problem solved in a timely and hopefully cost-effective manner. But, you know, the old story of I don't really care what you know until I know that you care is really, I mean, it's really true.
Yeah.
I've had some very good surgeons that I've sent patients to that are not necessarily the most collegial people to be around. And I just tell the patient, I say, look, this guy's really, really good, but he's not going to be warm and fuzzy. So just, you know, and then when they come back, they're happy because they go, yeah, well, he wasn't anything as, you know,
as bad as I thought.
Yeah, as bad as I thought. And oh yeah, by the way, my problem solved. Everybody's happy. So, you know, any technology that allows me to have a more human interaction with another person, I think is really the key. Everything else, you know, people are going to be a little bit suspect, you know,
and,
you know, especially in the last 3 years, you know, COVID ripped the Band-Aid off of a lot of stuff and made people really wonder about a lot of things in our healthcare systems and our regulatory bodies and whatnot.
Yeah. There was a company, I remember presenting about them at a conference in 2012. So a very long time ago, called Q Health. And they had these series of cubes that you could at home put like a pinprick of blood in, or they're different cubes for different things, saliva, urine, et cetera, on a little stick. And it would do a bit of a diagnosis, and then it would connect. If you needed to see a doctor, it would connect to your doctor through telehealth. And then you'd have the consultation with your doctor, and that would connect to your schedule, and the doctor would automatically, through the queue system, send it to the pharmacy that was closest to you, where you're going to be that day in your schedule. That wasn't approved by the FDA, but then during COVID it was. And I kind of don't know whether that's the way it's going to go, but I feel like we're going to have more of this interconnectivity through technology with all of the different aspects. So from the patient to the doctor, to the pharmacy, to, you know, all of those different areas. What do you think?
Well, I think it's, I mean, that's clearly happening now.
Yeah.
And when you look at, you know, the millennial generation, Gen Z, et cetera, that's how they do everything.
Yes.
I mean, my son is an aerospace engineer, and he said, how did you get through medical school without YouTube? And I said, well, we read books and went to libraries and actually had to pull things off of shelves and carry them around. But that's the expectation.
Yeah.
And you know, the fact that I've worked at places still where you can't make an appointment on your phone just boggles my imagination. I mean, that's the lowest hanging fruit there is.
Yeah.
You know, you push a button and food shows up at your house in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And yet, so I see that. Yes, 100%. When you see some of these direct to consumer pharmacies that, you know, sell ED drugs. Some are selling PrEP for HIV, where you might have a short 20-minute or 10-minute consult with a physician. They run through some things. They use that license, and then they dispense right to your house. I mean, that's a super common thing now in the United States. So I only see that expanding. Of course, you're kind of running through a forest of regulatory concerns. I remember in 2000, oh my gosh, it was a long time ago. It must have been 1998 or 99. We had a presentation at a conference I was at, and they were doing robotic beating heart bypass surgeries. And I was like, well, this is perfect because you get rid of the heart lung machine and all the complications with going on the pump, so to speak. And, you know, this is 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Where did that go?
Yeah.
I mean, we have robotic surgery, but I mean, that one seemed like a no-brainer.
Yeah.
We have some robotic assisted surgeries now, But how come, you know, it's so difficult to get these things tested and approved and through the regulatory system. And I get it. It's human medicine. But at the same time, you know, come on.
It's true. There's another company called Forward Health that was started by these ex-Google employees. And it's kind of a medical clinic, chain of clinics. And it's a subscription-based, I don't remember what it was, $99 a month or something. But it's really focused on health. So, you know, you come in and you get a body scan, you get your tests, and it's constantly monitoring, I guess, through your apps and things like that on your phone. But it's keeping track of all your various bio activity and very predictive. So they use AI and a lot of different things there. I really like the model because I think that, you know, a lot of the model now seems, at least in pharma, is focused on sickness. And I really like the model of health being focused on preventative and predictive health. Do you see that happening anywhere else?
No, and I remember reading about that. I mean, but here's the challenge. The challenge is people that are focused on prevention and health are generally fairly healthy. So for instance, you know, we have this explosion in the industrialized world of obesity and metabolic syndrome, you know, diabetes, et cetera.
Yeah.
Well, the treatment of that is actually really easy, and you don't necessarily need technology to tell you how to do it. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, eat less sugar, eat less processed food, eat, you know, potentially more protein, go for a walk. It's all really inexpensive things compared to medical technologies, but the downstream effect of not treating it is very, very expensive. You know, it's bypass surgeries, it's dialysis and all of these other things.
Yeah.
The problem is, and this is the challenge that I have on a day-to-day basis, is you have to engage people to actually change their behavior. Yeah. So if there is a Fitbit or a continuous glucose monitor or all these things that we could combine into one app that actually somehow figures out how to motivate people to, you know, own their health and change their behavior.
Yeah.
Then we have something really great, but people still have to be engaged. And this engagement is the part that is super duper frustrating. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of promoted, in my opinion, to a certain degree by a lot of, at least the pharma advertising I see. Mm. They show people, you're a diabetic. Oh, well, inject this peptide twice a week and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Instead of, you know, go to the gym.
I did this event a few weeks ago about AI, and I got all these people to get into little groups and brainstorm what they would want in their life in healthcare and AI. And I remember there was a woman who was in the group, and she came up with this idea that was kind of touching on this. So she came up with the idea of an AI-enabled teddy bear that was basically your conscience. So if you were at the supermarket buying the wrong foods, it was like, are you sure you really want to be buying that? And then she said, if you got up in the middle of the night and started having some snacks, it'd say, I really think you probably should not do that. But then we all agreed that probably a lot of people would just put a bag over the teddy bear's head for a while. Right. So, yeah. But, yeah, you could see that there would be – the technology exists that, you know, AI can interpret visually what's happening. It can calculate what the calories are in something, things like that. So you could see how that could be, but I think you will also need a lot more understanding of people's individual motivation and personalization in terms of what motivates each person, which will be different, of course.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I saw a really fascinating Instagram post a day or so ago, and this person was comparing, you know, the size of humans from, you know, the late 1890s. And they showed a picture of, you know, the world's fattest man that was traveling with the circus. And I mean, I could go to almost any store in my local area and find people bigger than him. And, you know, pictures of people walking down the street in New York City in 1930, and no one is obese. Like, it's amazing. And so they weren't really giving an answer, but they're asking the question. I mean, it's clearly this is more than just calories. Like, something is, like, we're poisoning ourselves some way that metabolically is unbelievably harsh.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you want to give, if you want to know what I want from AI, I want AI to figure out what that is.
Yeah.
We can stop doing that, you know?
There's a friend of mine in London is actually an architect, and she's building homes now that have AI in the bathroom mirror that detects micro changes in the face and body that are indicative of particular conditions. And the toilets do urine and feces analyses every day, and it goes to this dashboard that, you know, if there's anything picked up, it will tell you. Now, they're very expensive homes, but I suspect that some of that smart home technology will come down in price, as everything does with technology eventually. And we'll start to get a lot more in-home diagnostics going on. I don't know what you're seeing in that space.
Not a lot. I mean, the one that comes to mind that's been kind of blown up here, and definitely in the fitness world as well as in the metabolic disorders world, are the continuous glucose monitors. Mm-hmm. I mean, those were really, really expensive.
Yeah.
For quite a while, had to be approved by insurance company. It was, you know, a regulatory kind of nightmare. And, you know, now people just buy them. You just buy them over the counter. A lot of athletes are like, okay, you know, when I eat something, how does this react? I mean, whether or not it has any downstream effect in somebody that's not a diabetic, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But we're only going to see more and more of that.
I mean,
people that go on a ketogenic diet want keto strips. Well, is there a way to do that that's simpler? Like you said, mm-hmm. it's in your toilet.
Yeah.
I've always wondered, I mean, I've thought of this for decades. Why are not pap smears done on tampons? Why can't send, you know, have a certain reagent or whatever that you would store a tampon in, send it in and do all the analysis? I mean, there's tons of genetic material there.
That's true. That's a great idea.
You know, I mean, can you imagine? I would be a hero among women if we could.
Yes, I think you would be.
The annual gynae exam is done. Thank you. I'll take credit for that.
That's really cool. What about, I think that the area you touched on the very beginning was very interesting as well, that whole idea of the AI just taking the whole patient examination and putting it straight into the EMR. Medicine traditionally as a profession has a high level of burnout. And I'm wondering, you know, what other things AI could do that might be able to reduce physician burnout in their role?
I think this is a point where actually I get pretty excited because it could make a huge difference. My contention on burnout is this: people do not get burned out from hard work. And, you know, if you worked hard enough to get into medical school and compete your way through medical school and residency, you do not have a work ethic problem. It's not possible. People don't get burned out from hard work. They get burned out from what they see as useless work.
Yeah.
So me clicking a box so that it increases my downstream payments or the payments to the system that employs me or these kind of things that doesn't have a direct effect, or at least my interpretation is it does not have a direct effect on patient care. That's what burns people out.
Yeah.
It's these tasks that you have to do over and over and over again that feel almost demeaning and they actually get in the way, or the perception of from most physicians is it gets in the way of my doctor-patient relationship and doesn't enhance it.
Yeah.
So anything that takes that burden away and allows me to connect with people in a more, you know, human way is, you could sell that all day long. I mean, people will eat, the patient will eat that up, the physician will eat that up, the hospital systems will eat that up, and that's a direction I think that would be amazing. I mean, if you have companies that are doing that, tell me, because I would be more than happy to invest in that kind of thing.
Can you think 10 years in the future, what would be your vision of how a really good model of healthcare would be? Where do you think it could go if it went well?
Um, it, I mean, back.
We'll start with well, these pap smears on tampons.
Yeah. Right. No, if it went well, the key sort of driver for most patients is access with dignity. That's mm-hmm. it. So if they get access to somebody where they feel like they're treated with dignity, mm-hmm. Right now, that is what I see. When I go to work, people are super excited when they realize that I'm not going to judge them for whatever behavior they have, whether they're a smoker or not, whether, you know, whether they got vaccinated or not, who they sleep with. I mean, that's not my job as a physician. My job is to care for each individual that I see with dignity. But you have to actually be able to get into the office.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot in the future, I think tons will be done at home.
Yeah.
That makes the most sense. You have a problem. You don't necessarily want to make an appointment. You know, we live in an Uber and in, you know, an Uber Eats kind of world.
Yeah.
Clearly healthcare is going to go in that direction.
Yeah.
Hopefully that increases, it will increase access, but hopefully it also increases safety.
Yeah.
And better outcomes. That's where I see it going. We need to have a system where we need less healthcare providers. I mean, everywhere in the world, there's a huge demand, and there appears to be less and less of us for a variety of reasons.
Hmm. It's my just a story on that hospital at home concept. My mother, when she was 89, she's 90 now, had COVID, and where she lives, they have this hospital at home policy for particular conditions, depending on how severe they are. So they do a nurse assessment, then another nurse assessment on the phone. And then the doctor speaks to them and they check everything and then they make a diagnosis and tell them what to do. But it's all in the home. So it seems certainly for COVID, they were doing a lot of COVID at home treatments there. So I have heard of a few people working on this whole hospital from home systems in different parts of the world. So I think that is an area that probably will be, you know, I guess the real hospitals will be for trauma and acute and complex procedures. And then for things that aren't quite as serious, they get treated at home, which would decrease the burden on the hospital systems a bit too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, we call it like home health here.
Mm-hmm.
We've done a lot of that kind of stuff in the United States just because hospitalization is so unbelievably ridiculously overpriced and expensive.
Yeah.
So, you know, even IV infusion, somebody has a infection and they need IV antibiotics. Well, why can't you do that at home? Why can't you have you know, a nurse, you know, come out, start an IV? You can even remote in physicians if you needed to. A lot of that kind of stuff just makes absolutely perfect sense.
Yeah.
Home dialysis. I mean, we've done peritoneal dialysis for decades.
Yeah.
And actually it works pretty good, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't make dialysis companies as much money, but patients, when they get used to it, they love it. And, you know, I've often said to a lot of people, you know, you're your best doctor.
Yeah.
Because it's your body. You know your body.
Yeah.
You're coming to me for advice that hopefully is good advice that you choose to implement that makes your life better. That's mm-hmm. our goal.
Yeah.
So anything that aids in that, I'm for.
Yeah. Wow. Well, very, very interesting getting your perspective on this. You have your own podcast, BS Free MD. So I'm going to do a bit of a plug for it because I think it would be very interesting to my listeners, because most of them are in pharma, to get your perspective on on a lot of things. So if anyone wants to hear Tim's podcast, if you look up BS Free MD, which he does with his wife, Dr. May Hindmarsh, which is a funny and honest look at medicine. So I definitely would like, you know, to let people know about that. Thank you so much for your time today. Fascinating to talk about it from the doctor perspective. And hopefully we can come up with another topic and get you back on again soon.
Excellent. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.